Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is February 7th, and I want to go quickly. We have to introduce some committee measures, and I would like to open a work session to introduce committee measures. Senator Steiner-Hayward, would you help me on this?
Thank you very much. Chair Monasanderson, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills. LC 1620, dated November 30th, 2016. LC 1632, dated October 7th, 2016. LC 1634, dated December 2nd, 2016. And LC 1690, dated January 13th, 2017.
Senator Steiner-Hayward moves that the following LCs be introduced: LC 1620, dated 11/30/2016; LC 1632, dated 10/7/2016; LC 1634, dated 12/2/2016; and LC 1690, dated 1/13/2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills, and I will close the work session on the introduction of committee measures. Now, I would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 332. Would you summarize the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 332. The bill is solely before you today to referral without recommendation to the President's desk.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 332 without recommendation be referred back to the President's desk for re-referral to the Committee on Business and Transportation.
Vice Chair Cruz moves Senate Bill 332 without recommendation back to the Speaker for
President. We're in the Senate now.
We are. My script says something different. For re-referral to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, the motion passes, and it's on its way out of this committee, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 332. Now, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 271. Oliver, could you...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 271, and comes to you at the request of Cambia Health Solutions. The measure codifies in Oregon law the federal definition of small employer to at least one but no more than 50 full-time employees. Legislative revenue and fiscal offices have issued impact statements. There is no revenue impact. Bill has minimal fiscal impact. There are no amendments. Provided testimony is available on OLIS.
All right, Tom Holt and Lana Butterfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Tom Holt, Cambia Health Solutions, here in support of Senate Bill 271. We appreciate you having an early hearing on this. This bill is truly a housekeeping bill. It's on a little piece of the ACA that's had a convoluted history. And this committee acted on this subject in the 2015 session. Originally, the ACA required states to expand small group or the definition of small employer up to 100 employees, and we were then at a 50 employee limit in Oregon. That move would have had a very negative rating impact on employers in that 51 to 100 space. That's a very competitive part of the market. It also would have required those employers to go to the cookie cutter small group plans, which they did not want to do. And there was sort of a national hue and cry about that. And in 2015, in what still is the only bipartisan revision to the ACA, Congress very wisely gave states the permission to keep the limit at 50. You all had passed the bill that allowed DCBS to change its rules to be in alignment with that. DCBS has done that. But so now we still have a little cross-reference to a federal statute that might change. What this bill does is really just finally settles the matter and puts this policy decision back where it belongs in the legislature's hands going forward. We have discussed this with DCBS, and they have no objection that I'm aware of. So we would respectfully request that we move this bill along with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here on behalf of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. And with Doug and I, you have two of the insurance agent groups roundly supporting Senate Bill 271, more for who it excludes than who it includes. That aspect of 51 to 100 is a unique demographic, and when it is not included in this definition, it retains a lot of benefits that are good for them. So we agree with this bill. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. We worked extensively on this issue during the interim with businesses in that 51 to 100 group that would be impacted if the definition were to change, with some of you and with the insurance division to keep the small group definition at 2 to 50. We're totally convinced that this is the right step to take and encourage your support of the bill. Thank you.
Questions? We've had this before this committee before, and thank you for those who businesses in my district that allowed me to come to see how it would really impact them if we didn't keep it to 50 and under. So with that, is there anyone else to testify? I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 271, and are you ready for a work session, committee?
Sure.
I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 271.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 271 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 271 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Kendall.
Aye.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 271. And now we will open a public hearing on open an informational hearing on Tobacco 21. Senator Steiner Hayward. And shall we bring up Dr. Brian Drucker, Dr. Bud Pierce, and Dr. Patrick Haggerty?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator for Senate District 17 and one of the chief sponsors of this bill. As a family physician, I firmly believe that preventing disease is better than curing it. And one of the best ways we can prevent disease in this state is to reduce the use of tobacco in any form and inhalant delivery systems. We know that tobacco is one of the leading causes of illness and death in Oregon. It's incredibly expensive. It costs every Oregon household almost $800 a year to take care of smokers, regardless of whether they have one in their household or not. It costs the Oregon Health Authority and our Medicaid program an additional $1,600 per year per smoker, which is a big sum of money, especially when we're facing times like this. It's also personal to me. I lost my father, my father-in-law, and a beloved aunt to smoking-related illnesses, and I'm sure that every single person on this committee has had a similar experience. We do not see this as a partisan issue. The bill has bipartisan co-sponsorship in both chambers, and we're very excited about that. This is a public health bill and about improving the lifelong health of Oregonians. We know that the longer we delay people being exposed to nicotine, which is a substance that is more addictive than cocaine, that they're less likely to become addicted as brains develop. And we think that increasing the age to 21, just as alcohol and marijuana are 21, will make a significant difference in the likelihood of people becoming addicted to this substance. I want to take just a couple of minutes to get this. This bill just got dropped. It is now, by the way, Senate Bill 754. And it got dropped yesterday, first read today. And I want to just run through the bill very quickly for the benefit of the committee, because at first glance, it's a 33-page bill, and that can cause people to freak out. I want to tell you that everything important in the bill is on the first three pages. The rest of it is all conforming amendments. So it's just a changing the number 18 to 21 throughout statute. That's all that's on the remaining 30 pages of the bill. So the first section, Section 1, it points out that it covers all tobacco products and what we call in the state inhalant delivery systems after the legislation we passed in 2015 limiting the sale of and use of inhalant delivery systems to people 18 and above. The second section defines penalties for retailers, and we firmly believe that store clerks and store owners want to do the right thing and try to do the right thing. We also recognize that sometimes people make mistakes. We want to focus on education and not penalties. So we've made some pretty substantial changes in this. Currently, for context, the current penalty for selling tobacco to a minor is a Class A violation, which means that there's a criminal record. It's a violation. It's a ticket, but it's still a criminal interaction with no less than $250 fine up to $1,000. Under the new legislation, it would be a civil penalty of $50 for the clerk, because we know that most clerks are people who are working hard to get themselves through school, provide a little extra money for their families, and they're not the ones who really can't afford or should be held accountable in a lot of ways. On the other hand, managers, for the first violation, it's a $500 fine for the second, and then can go up to $1,000 for the third or subsequent. And for the store owners, it's $1,000 for the first and second violations within a two-year period, $5,000 for third and subsequent. Fortunately, in Oregon, we don't have very many stores that end up with multiple violations in a two-year period. So we think the chances of anybody incurring these larger penalties is small, but we want to have them on the books as a deterrent effect. Again, we're keeping it as a civil penalty, not a violation or a misdemeanor. And just to be clear, that a clerk furnishing alcohol to a minor is a Class A misdemeanor. The third section does include a Class A violation if you don't have proper signage. Again, we are pretty confident that every store in Oregon that sells these products has proper signage. I was doing self-checkout at Safeway the other day and noticed it right in the checkout stand. So I think people are pretty good about that. The fourth section requires law enforcement, teachers, employers, other authority figures to confiscate these products if they see somebody under the age of 21 with them. I want to be crystal clear about this, and we've been very careful about how we structured it. It's confiscation only. It's only confiscation of visible product, so they can't do a search of the person. It doesn't qualify as probable cause for an additional search. We don't want this to result in increased interactions of a negative sort with law enforcement. That's not the goal of this bill. As I said before, it's a public health bill, and that's all we're looking for. So we've worked on this very, very hard to structure it in a way that doesn't penalize people unduly. We don't want to criminalize underage tobacco use. Fifth section requires employers to train their employees not to sell to people under 21. We think, again, most employers are already doing this pretty well. We just want to remind them to keep doing it. And sections 6 through 29 change the reference to from minor, which is what counts as under 18 in Oregon, to age 21 throughout. And then there's an e-clause which will allow for rulemaking. The change itself does not take effect until January 1st of 2018. The bill has really broad support, including people you wouldn't normally expect to engage in this type of legislation. The Oregon Military Department supports the bill because they see tobacco use as a threat to military readiness, as does the Pentagon. The police chiefs and sheriffs support the bill because of readiness and because their officers are having difficulty determining what kinds of products people are using now that cannabis is legal in the state. And the inhalant delivery systems, you can't tell if there's THC products in them or nicotine products in them. By raising the age to 21, we will decrease access. You'll hear from teenagers that those of them who are over 18 are being pressured by their peers to buy tobacco products. We know that people in high school are much less likely to have access to people over 21 on a daily basis, and we want to decrease access. I'm going to let my colleagues talk about the importance medically. I will say that this kind of legislation has been very effective in the over 200 local jurisdictions and two states where it's been enacted already. I very much hope that Oregon will be the third state to do it statewide. Thank you. Happy to take questions now or wait till later.
Let's hear the panel.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. I'm Dr. Brian Drucker, Director of the OHS Unite Cancer Institute. It's a pleasure to be here to testify on behalf of this bill, and I want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward for introducing this. When I became director of the Knight Cancer Institute, one of my pledges was to decrease the number of people who die from cancer in our state to the lowest in the country. Tobacco use still accounts for one-third of all cancer-related deaths in the country as well as our state. That accounts for close to 200,000 deaths in the United States every year. And in Oregon, that's approximately 6,000. We know that the primary time when people become addicted to smoking is in their late teen years, between 16 and 21. And we also know if we can delay that, we can decrease the number of the people who become lifelong addicts. There was a recent study in Needham, Massachusetts, where they enacted a 21-year age restriction. In the high schools, they saw a 47% decrease in the number of children that were smoking. If we saw a 20% decrease in the numbers of smokers in our state, we'd save 1,000 lives every single year. If you look at the financial implications of this, we see about a $3 billion loss in productivity and in resources that go to health care every single year. Again, a 10% decrease would be a $300 million savings every year. The Medicaid budget for that is $374 million. Again, a 10% decrease would be a $37 million per year saving. So you can look at this from an economic point of view. You can look at this from a health savings point of view. Either way you look at it, if we raise the age of smoking, we'll see a decrease in the numbers of youth that are addicted to smoking, and we will ultimately save lives, and that's what I care most deeply about. So I want to thank you for your consideration of this, and I'm going to turn this over to my friend and colleague, Dr. Bud Pierce.
Thank you. All righty, so thanks for letting me speak. I'm Dr. Bud Pierce, and I am a practicing cancer doctor, and this is my 40th year in practicing medicine. And through the years, I've taken care of many, and I speak in favor of the measure, obviously, and I speak because the American Cancer Society asked me to, and I always do what they ask me to do, pretty much. So this is my 40th year in practice, and I've taken care of many thousands of cancer patients, and many of them started smoking when they were children, and they couldn't quit, or they quit after it was too late, and they end up getting incurable cancer, and they would experience suffering and miserable deaths prematurely because of their tobacco addiction. Tobacco is a unique product, especially cigarettes, in that when used as directed, it is guaranteed to harm your health, 100% guaranteed, used as directed. And that's pretty unique amongst products that are approved in America. And finally, I will wrap this up by speaking to my fellow Republicans, my legislators who are Republicans, and I view this not as a more, I don't look at this as a big government issue or a freedom issue or a choice issue. I look at it as a moral issue. And are we going to continue to allow cigarette companies to sell their products to the poor and to the weak and to the children solely for money, irrespective of the health consequences? Or are we going to do what we can to lessen it? So I'd ask the Republicans especially to support this measure. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Patrick Haggerty here with the Oregon Dental Association, and as well in my new position at OHSU with the newly formed department called the Hospital Dental Service. 30 years of private practice and then jumping to OHSU, my experiences have changed dramatically. Certainly the cancers that I saw, oral cancers that I saw in my practice, you know, I can count 12, 15 that I picked up over the course of my practice. But now in my work at OHSU, I see them on a daily basis. And working with these patients as they begin their journey of cancer care, surgery, chemo, radiation, every one of them in the tobacco-related cancers talk about starting their smoking habit as a teenager. Anything we can do to delay the parade of nicotine dependence is only going to help our Oregonians. Less than the cancer, periodontitis, losing teeth. The number one risk factor for losing your teeth is smoking. Not known widely. We have these people come in who are smokers. Again, tell the story of starting as a teenager. We talk about their immune system having one arm tied behind its back. It cannot function to treat the infection, maybe minor to begin with, that then gets a foothold, and they wind up losing teeth. I have three residents in the overflow room who are getting outstanding training in the management of these oral cancer patients and these periodontal disease patients. I'd really like to see their training become less relevant. They would too. We need to do this for Oregonians. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. First of all, does this include vaping and e-cigarettes?
Yes, ma'am.
And the second question is probably for the doctors. Well, of course, you're all doctors.
All the doctors. You guys are here just fine as doctors. I'm here just fine as a senator.
Nicotine doesn't cause cancer, correct?
Actually, it does.
Okay. Because I had heard the Royal Academy Institute states that...
Yeah, I think the British, it's interesting when you talk to them, they look at it as a way to help people stop smoking and as an alternative if they won't smoke. And then, that's kind of a cultural thing, so there's a lot of discussion of that in the English literature. What Americans are concerned about is it looks like we transition, and again, nicotine itself isn't good for you. But again, I think they would argue that it's less bad, because when you have nicotine, pure nicotine, it's problematic, but not horribly problematic. When you have cigarettes, you have a lot of carcinogens that come along with it.
If I may, though, Madam Chair, I would add that we do know that nicotine has an effect on developing brains, and that its use changes brain chemistry, and it ultimately can lead to some challenges in impulse control, which we know is already an issue for young people as their brains develop and their prefrontal cortex develops over the course of the first 20 to 25 years of their life. So we know that it can have long-term implications, and we know that developing brains are much more susceptible to its effect than older brains are, which is why the vast majority of addicted users start before they're 18.
Okay. Because I have heard the argument that vaping, you can't compare that to cigarette use.
Yes, that is true, and I'm happy to provide you some medical literature on nicotine, isolated nicotine being carcinogenic. It is much worse, as Dr. Pierce said, when you combine it with all the tars and other things that go into cigarette products.
And if I may, Madam Chair, we don't yet really have enough evidence to know what the harms are from the liquids that are used in these inhalant delivery systems. I would remind you that, much to my profession's discredit, doctors used to recommend smoking for relaxation, and you will see ads back in the old magazines. And until the Surgeon General's report in the 1960s that clearly demonstrated the link between tobacco use and cancer, people didn't see it as a particularly harmful product. So I would agree with my colleagues. Obviously, avoiding the small particulate matter and tars that come with cigarettes and other tobacco products is a good thing, and it's probably less worse, if you will, to use inhalant delivery systems. I don't think it's at all fair to say that it's safe. It's probably less worse is the best we can say about it. And there's no reason to think it's a good idea to let kids become addicted to it in that form either.
Do we have the states that have passed it? Do we have information as to the amount of decrease of use among youth?
Yes, Hawaii is just about a year old, and California it's too soon. The data that I mentioned from Needham is actually quite some time, and that was extremely striking data about the percent decrease in high school usage. So that's the only data I've seen where there's been a follow-up over time.
And if I may, the analogy I would make is that in the late 70s and early 80s, virtually all states changed their legal drinking age from 18 to 21. And pretty much nationwide, the average decrease in underage drinking was about somewhere between 25 and 35%. So there's no reason to think it wouldn't be analogous.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. So the youth panel is Mason Thurman from Valley Catholic, Maddie Campbell from Providence Rebel, Madeline Swint from Providence Rebel, and Emma Monson from Providence Rebel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. See Mason. You want to go?
Okay.
Chair Montes Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Emma Monson. I am currently a senior at Westview High School, and I am also a Providence Rebel. I'm here today to encourage you to vote yes on raising the age of the sale of all tobacco products to 21 years of age. 2 weeks ago, as I sat on the bleachers cheering my high school's basketball team to victory, I heard a conversation between a freshman and one of my senior classmates. They were discussing arrangements for the 18-year-old to buy the freshman cigarettes. I sat there stunned, disgusted, and angry. Later that same week, I was in my local convenience store buying a pack of gum when I saw another senior classmate of mine purchasing cigarettes. He must have seen my look of disbelief as he reposed, "What? I'm 18. These are only a few examples of situations I'm sure occur numerous times daily. This is evidenced by the littering of cigarettes on my walk to school and in the school parking lot. Although 18 is the age of a legal adult, I can tell you from personal experience I am still learning to make important decisions. Most of my peers struggle to see the long-term consequences of their decisions. Most are subject and easily succumb to peer pressure. The choice to purchase and smoke cigarettes is an agreement to a life bound by illness and addiction. This is why I chose to join the Providence Rebels to educate my classmates on these long-term impacts. To ask such an influential decision of anyone under 18 is unfair. The right to a healthy and prosperous life is not being protected by allowing the substance in schools. As nearly 95% of smokers begin before the age of 21, millions of dollars and lives could be saved by simply eliminating the number of high school students that can purchase tobacco, thereby stopping the distribution to younger students. The prevention of such easy access could stop the formation of this costly habit for many. I'm here to defend the rights of children like my little brothers, who cannot do so themselves but are subject to the detrimental influence of tobacco daily. I ask you to take a stand and protect a very vulnerable population of people who oftentimes do not have a voice of their own. If you are given the opportunity, I urge you to support raising the age of tobacco sales to 21. Thank you.
Chair Montes Anderson and the members of the committee, my name is Madeline Swint. I'm a junior at Beaverton High School and part of the Providence Rebels. I'm here today to encourage you to support raising the age of sale of all tobacco to 21. Tobacco, like many others, has touched my life negatively. Tobacco use is the number one cause of cancer, and my grandfather was a victim of this. At the age of 10, my grandfather started smoking. Like many young adults his age, tobacco was part of everyday life. It was not until he was 65 that his lifetime use of tobacco caused him to develop colon cancer and suffer a stroke. I was too young to comprehend what was going on, but I recall not being able to spend time with him because of the emotional stress the cancer brought. His 55-year addiction was something that not only impacted him, but our whole family. Young adults already have to deal with copious amounts of stress, trying to juggle our relationships, education, jobs, and thinking about our futures, adding an addiction that will wreak havoc on our free time, bank accounts, social lives, reputations, and our health will only enhance the extensive amount of worry and anxiety that we go through every day. By raising the age of sale of all tobacco, we will help reduce the rate of smokers and preventable deaths. It will benefit how this generation teaches the next and will cause a pattern of healthy life habits demonstrated by humanity far into the future. If you are given the opportunity, I urge you to support raising the age of tobacco to 21. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Montes Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Madison Campbell. I'm a junior at Beaverton High School, and I'm here today to encourage you to support raising the age of sale of all tobacco to 21 and to protect other 16-year-olds like myself from a lifetime addiction to tobacco. I learned to associate the smell of smoke with love for my grandpa. When I was young, I didn't know what my grandpa was doing was bad. I thought it was normal. My grandpa started smoking before he was 18. He was able to walk to his corner store of his small town, appear 18, and buy a pack every day. He was 16, like me. He continued to use tobacco until he was 55. Due to getting addicted to tobacco early, my grandfather was a statistic of a lifetime smoker. He developed gum cancer at 60. I watched him lose his teeth and saw the emotional effects of having to be at the mercy of his doctors to support his needs. If the age to buy tobacco was 21, it could have prevented his habit that chased him every day of his life, that in the end gave him cancer and changed his perspective. His story is not unique to the deadly consequences of getting addicted to tobacco at a young age. If you are given the opportunity, I urge you to support raising the age of tobacco to 21. I do not want to see any more of my peers getting addicted to tobacco and end up later like my grandfather. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I have a question for any of you. What is Providence Revel?
So Providence Revels is a peer-to-peer anti-tobacco group. So we focus on educating our peers on the detrimental effects of tobacco. And we do this through presenting in middle schools different events. For instance, this Friday we're presenting at the Hillsborough Health Fair. So we set up booths. We have fun games and activities that draw people to our booth where we're able to educate them on the dangers of the substance.
Thank you. Well, I'm so glad that you took the time to come down here and give us information. Any questions? Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
With that, we have some county commissioners. Lane County Commissioner is at Bozovich, and Multnomah County Commissioner Myron, and Klamath County Commissioner DeGroot.
Go ahead. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jay Bozovich. I'm a Lane County Commissioner, and as such, I'm also a member of the local Board of Health, and our commission takes our role as the Board of Health very seriously. I grew up in a tobacco state. I stuck my first cigarette somewhere between 10 and 13 years old, you know, camping trips or out in the woods or whatever with my buddies. By 15, I was a half-pack-a-day smoker. Maryland, though, at that time, you could buy cigarettes in vending machines. The age of purchase was 16, and they were mostly unattended vending machines, and I had a paper route, so I had ready cash. It took me till 25 to quit, and I was probably one of the lucky ones that I had the willpower to do so, but 10 years of nicotine addiction from that childhood experience. Lane County identified tobacco prevention in our community health improvement plan as part of our CCO way back in 2014 as one of our primary goals. And as such, we started moving forward with many initiatives, including retail licensing, which we'll be talking about later. But we've actually started moving forward with a Tobacco 21 ordinance at the local level. The number one source for tobacco for kids that are minors under the age of 18 is peers, siblings, and friends that are between 18 and 21. Once somebody is 21, they're much less likely to supply a 17-year-old with cigarettes or tobacco products. So it's really an evidence-based, as you heard from the doctors, objectively studied, effective way of managing tobacco prevention. You know, I come to you as not only a Republican, but a former Libertarian, so, you know, you might not think I'd be the one up here talking about Tobacco 21. And in fact, I was the lone no vote against an outdoor ban of smoking in our county because I did not have any evidence base provided to me that outdoor smoking bans actually are effective. And I thought it had more to do with access to public property for our entire public. So I urge you to move ahead with a statewide initiative because it will be much more effective than localities. You know, there are the boundary issues of, you know, the kids from Junction City High School can just travel to Harrisburg to, you know, with a peer that's 19 to purchase their tobacco product. I'd like to kind of deal with that, move ahead on a statewide basis, and hopefully really put a dent in youth smoking because really it's about protecting minors. And that's, you know, as a Libertarian, it's the one place I kind of draw the line. You're really not an adult to make that decision to poison yourself. You know, I supported, you know, Measure 91 and other reductions of prohibition once you're an adult. You have a right kind of to be stupid. But it's really about protecting children, and cutting off that source with Tobacco 21 is a very effective way, well studied, well shown, and I fully support it, and I hope you'll move ahead with it.
Thank you. Chair Monis Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here and all these panels today. For the record, my name is Sharon Myron. I am the Multnomah County Commissioner for District 1, and I'm also a member of our local Board of Health. I am very proud to be here today to join the chorus of voices in support of raising our state's minimum age to purchase tobacco. As an ER doctor, so I could have been on the other panel too, but I'm on this one. As an emergency room doctor, I regularly treat people and see people every day who come in suffering from the effects of tobacco-related illness. And this is across the lifespan. The part that always gets to me is when I walk into a room to see a kid who's there for an asthma exacerbation, and you walk in and the entire room, there's like a cloud of tobacco smoke. It just smells like tobacco. You're like, wow, this is impressive. So who smokes? And the parents are the ones who are smoking, and they are often at this point teenage parents. I mean, they're often 18, 19, 20-year-olds who now have a child that they're also exposing to this illness. I also care for many adults with lung cancer, emphysema, head and neck cancers, and the impacts are devastating. This isn't just anecdote at this point. As we've heard, there is a lot of evidence supporting the fact that the age of initiation of tobacco use among adults who go on to become daily smokers, approximately 90% report their first use occurred before they were 19. So these tobacco-related illnesses, deaths, complications, and costs are all preventable. So I am not here just today in my role as a doctor. I'm also here as a new county commissioner, very proud to serve in a county that's demonstrated leadership and taken action on tobacco policy locally. So two states, more than 180 municipalities in several states have raised the age of purchase, and countless others are considering the same. And I'm here with my representatives from a couple of our local jurisdictions today for this reason, that I hope we as a state will be able to join the ranks here. Multnomah County, as you probably know, passed a retail licensing ordinance in 2015, began issuing licenses last year, and the board also later in the year began exploring countywide T21 adoption. And the board, we are dedicated to moving forward with this at the county level while it's being vetted at the state level as well. So although I represent Multnomah County, I'm dedicated to improving the health of all Oregonians. And so I urge you, along with the others here, to pass this tobacco legislation at the state level. Thank you for your time and your dedication to this critical issue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me. For the record, my name is Derek DeGroot, Vice Chair of the Klamath County Board of Commissioners. Klamath County is currently working on measures also to properly monitor tobacco use in our area, but the facts are that 28% of 11th graders in Klamath County and 13.8% of 8th graders currently use tobacco in the last 30 days. 14% of 11th graders and 4% of 8th graders are reported as regular tobacco users in Klamath County. Each year in Klamath County, 3,836 people suffer from a serious illness caused by tobacco use, and 25% of all deaths in Klamath County can be attributed to tobacco use. Each year in Klamath County, $39.1 million is spent on medical care for tobacco-related illnesses, and it's estimated that $31.4 million is lost in productivity due to tobacco-related deaths. We're not a huge county. Those are huge numbers for us. Statistics indicate that 90% of smokers begin before the age of 18, and almost no one starts smoking after the age of 25. More specifically, cigarette sales to those under 21 only account for 2.12% of total sales, but because 90% of smokers start smoking by the age of 21, those are the very sales that help lead to 9 out of 10 new smokers. This means that the impact on store owners will be minimal, and will only affect a very small percentage of tobacco sales in the short term. I've heard a lot of people talk about the youth, and I really enjoyed the young ladies that were here testifying before you this morning, or earlier. I, too, have teenagers in my house, so it's a little personal to me. I have an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old, and I can tell you that they are not ready to make these types of decisions. Nor was I when I bought my first pack of cigarettes when I was 14. It took me till the age of about 30 before I was able to quit smoking. Probably one of the most difficult things that I've accomplished in my life, including running for office. This is not a partisan issue. From a very conservative part of the state, another fellow Republican county commissioner, I can tell you that this is something that we as leaders in Oregon need to come together and protect our children, and maybe we can be looked at as the ones that finally stood up and said enough. Our young people do not need to grow into an old and agonizing death. So thank you very much for sitting down.
I do have a couple of questions regarding the licensure from Lane County. Do you know how much each retail entity has to is charged to be licensed to sell tobacco?
It's $250.
It's not a significant amount. I think it's $250.
Okay.
For our we only license in the unincorporated areas.
Oh, unincorporated.
Yeah, because okay. Most of the cities also license, and I think their fees are higher than ours.
And I think Multnomah County's is $560 or something like that.
$580.
Okay, so it varies. Okay, any questions for this panel? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. From the county commissioners, I'm curious, how do you enforce your programs now?
I would say generally it's enforced by the retailers. One of the reasons we established the retail licensing was to generate a revenue stream to do both education and enforcement with. So we are going, we just established that retail licensing about a year ago. So we're just starting to do some of the localized enforcement. A lot of it happens through the state and the federal government also. But, with at least Tobacco 21, the enforcement mechanism's already there. There's already enforcement for sales at 18, so it's just moving it to 21. And then it matches up very well with marijuana and alcohol sales. So, all that enforcement can, sting operations can use the same minors and all. So it's generally retailers want to do the right thing. It's very rare we'll find a retailer intentionally violating the age of sales limit. So it's self-enforcing almost.
And any other questions?
Is that true of the other counties too? Is there anybody who has an aggressive enforcement program?
So we do not. Right now we are working on a tobacco retail licensing program. We don't currently have one in Klamath County. We are a more rural part of the state, so getting state inspections on our retailers are a little bit more difficult. It's something that we're looking at trying to implement locally, but we don't have one now.
And I think that the next bill, the 235, we'll learn a little bit more about licensure.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you. If I may, I might just comment. The statistics about compliance are actually pretty good in Oregon. I mean, we definitely have people who don't comply, and that's why the education and enforcement that our panelists and you have referred to are really important. However, our Sting data suggests that people are doing pretty well and they want to comply. As I said in my testimony, we believe store owners and store employees want to comply with the law and they recognize the importance of doing so. So it's important to have robust enforcement programs so that we can do this education. My daughter actually used to serve as a Sting teenager until she turned over 17 and couldn't do it anymore. And she was a little dubious about it at first, but when she discovered that clerks who passed, who wouldn't sell to her, actually got rewarded, she started to feel a lot better about it, and she did see the educational component. So do we have enough money for enforcement? No. Do we do enough of it? Unclear. Do we do enough education? No. But overall, people are doing pretty well. So raising the legal age shouldn't change that part of it. In fact, it should make it a little bit easier because clerks will only have to remember 1 year date rather than two. So,
and I was talking to the vaping industry this morning, and they were one of the vape shops in Gresham has already been investigated. They're paying their $580, and it's going very well, according to him. And they said they have no problems with the investigative process. So already that's happening, and it's only been a few months or a year in Multnomah County. Okay. Well, thank you very much, and everyone.
Thank you very much.
That is the end of the informational hearing on Tobacco 21. As you know, now that we have a bill number, it goes through a process, and then it will be assigned probably to this committee. And as soon as it's assigned to this committee, then we will set up a date. So I would say in a week or so, whenever we get the bill, but I can't give you a date right now. Other questions? Okay, I will close the informational hearing on Tobacco 21. And, yes, that's it, okay. So just a question for the analysts here. Are the people ready for this when?
She's next door. She won't be here for another 15 minutes.
Okay. What I'd like to do is recess for about 15 minutes because those that want to testify are testifying in the next room, and as soon as they're ready, we'll have our next public hearing. So we are now in recess.
They don't have another one posted, do they?
I'd like to reconvene the Health Care Committee, and I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235. I would like, Oliver, would you describe the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 235, the measure creates a statewide tobacco retail licensing program. The measure also provides the Department of Revenue the authority to discipline both licensees and persons selling tobacco or inhalant delivery systems without a license in Oregon. The measure would require the Department of Revenue to enter into agreements with the Oregon Health Authority and local public health authorities to oversee enforcement of the laws, ordinances, and rules of the program.
Thank you. Mark Mayer, will you come up and go through the bill with us? Just tell us what's in the bill.
Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I was the drafter assigned to this particular bill, and I've been asked to come today to just briefly go over the contents of the bill and draw your attention to whatever I think might be of value to you as you consider it. The bill basically has...
But before you go, do you want to describe the group that worked on this?
Yes, I was directed this summer by the requester to work, and the requester has given me permission to divulge this information. The requester sent me to work with a work group that was hosted by the Oregon Health Authority. The Oregon Health Authority was present, as was Multnomah County, the Department of Revenue, and basically those three parties were trying to figure out how to make licensure work in this state when there is a complex set of laws that currently exist and that currently delegate different duties to different agencies, as well as the fact that Multnomah had already instituted their own licensure program. So that was the work group that I was working with, and that was giving me direction as to what they wanted to see in the bill that I prepared.
Thank you.
So the bill basically has four parts. The first part is licensure by the Department of Revenue, and I'll go into that in a little bit more detail in a minute. The second part is streamlining as well as modifying duties, held under current statute by the Oregon Health Authority with respect to tobacco products. So it will work with what we did with the licensing provisions, as well as to further streamline their processes. And then the final was to codify local government's responsibility with respect to tobacco products. So those three things occur in this bill. Then on top of that, there is a section that requires information and fee-sharing mechanisms to be employed to fund these various programs, but at the same time to make it hopefully collected at one point and distributed more easily than if it were to occur at all three levels. So those are the four different parts of the bill. The primary bulk of the bill, most of the bill, is dedicated to setting up the licensing scheme by the Department of Revenue. And essentially what that is intended to do is create a licensing scheme where if you sell electronic cigarettes or you sell tobacco products in this state, you have to have a license to do that. There are a couple of carve-outs, just little tiny ones. In Oregon law, inhalant delivery system, which is the term used to refer to electronic cigarette, that also includes the device that you use to inhale from. If you're currently licensed by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to sell marijuana products, or you're registered with the Oregon Health Authority to sell marijuana products, and you're selling those devices, you don't have to get a duplicative license. So you don't have to do it for that reason. However, if you're unlicensed by any entity and you're selling one of those, you do have to be licensed. We use current definitions for tobacco products and inhalant delivery systems or electronic cigarettes. The licensure itself doesn't require a lot in the way of qualifications to be licensed. The licensed a premises that's going to sell these products, it must be fixed and permanent. It's language that we took out of the revenue code. Basically, it can't be a mobile premises. Secondly, it has to be located in an area that is not zoned exclusively for residential use. This is language that you've probably seen in a lot of the marijuana bills that we've drafted. So it has to be in mixed use or commercial use zones or industrial.
One question on that. Sometimes the zoning happens and there's already existing businesses that get exempted. How would that impact them?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, in the current draft, since the license, that qualification is for licensure, once you're licensed, you could remain at that location. However, I think the way it's written, upon renewal, you would no longer be qualified in the way it's currently written.
So basically a mom-and-pop store that's in a neighborhood that has been, since that zoned residential, could no longer sell cigarettes?
The way it's currently written, correct.
Okay.
Okay, moving on. So those are the qualifications that are in the current draft. Another thing to remember, or another thing that's in this draft, is that there is going to be information sharing with certain agencies with regard to licensure information, the stuff that's submitted to the Department of Revenue, but that is going to be limited to the Oregon Health Authority and local public health authorities with whom the Department of Revenue is also going to enter into other agreements for information sharing purposes in order to ensure that there's consistent regulation of tobacco products. The department is going to publish a list that includes the names of the licensees on a website. However, all other information is going to be confidential except through the fee sharing provision.
Yes.
So Mark, the statute refers to person in this context. If it's like a chain store, 7-Eleven, would it be licensed to? That's probably a bad example because they're franchise. Say Safeway. Mm-hmm. If Safeway sells it, do they get one license and list all the premises?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Beyer, within this draft, I have to read it really carefully now. the licenses are issued to qualified premises. Shall issue licenses to and annually renew licenses for a person that sells at qualified premises. I think there's a little bit of play in that language because it's issued to the person. And so the way it's written, it could reasonably be interpreted by the Department of Revenue that's going to adopt rules for this, that one-stop shop for a multi-premises a person where they can get one license for all their different premises.
So why wouldn't we just say the premises has to have a license rather than the person? I realize under law that could be defined that way, but it seems like it creates some confusion that's going to get into a problem in drafting OARs.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Beyer, I don't have much to say on that except for, you know, it is a policy choice for you to make. With the alcohol laws and the marijuana laws, we license the premises, as you're probably very familiar with.
Yeah. That would make more sense.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that. It would be a shame to think that Safeway pays the same for a license for all of their stores in one lump as Joe's Corner Grocery would pay, too. That didn't seem to be
necessarily
somewhat.
Say that. Huh? I said I didn't necessarily imply that.
I did.
All right, so moving along, the next few provisions are pretty standard language. We have revocation, suspension, refusal to issue or renew language for the licenses. If you're a bad actor, any one of those things with respect to your license can occur through due process, and a civil penalty too. If you're thinking about past versions of this bill, there's a difference here in that in past versions, there was kind of a bifurcated due process track where if it was a tax matter, it would go through the tax court. If it was a different matter, it would go through a administrative proceeding, due process proceeding. This draft assumes that everything's going to go through administrative proceeding. That was a request that the Department of Revenue made when they were rewriting this. Just let's keep everything the same and move everybody through the same process. Contains the seizure language that is also in the revenue code with respect to cigarettes. If there is a bad actor, their product can be seized by the Department of Revenue. Suspense account rules, and then, of course, the intergovernmental agreement, which I'll come back to later because it's probably the linchpin and more easily explained if I talk about the other two pieces of this first. So with respect to the next few provisions, sections, I think it's 14, 15, and 16, we're standardizing some of the language with respect to OHA's responsibility to tobacco products in statutory law, as well as streamlining some of their processes, or the bill does that. For instance, there is a duplicative program on the books, ORS 181, 8330, and 335 that is repealed in this bill. And then we've also rewritten some of the language here so it matches the language in the Department of Revenue sections. Probably the most significant policy choice that you might want to draw your attention to is on page 6. A civil penalty that the Oregon Health Authority may impose is increased to $5,000 against retailers of tobacco products and electronic cigarettes. It was at $1,000 before. Also on page 6, section 16, this section, and I want to speak clearly here because I don't want anybody to read too much into this, it basically codifies the ability that the Oregon Health Authority already has, for the most part, to enter into an agreement with the FDA for tobacco product retailer inspections. The Oregon Health Authority has already entered into that agreement. They already have the FDA contract to conduct federal inspections of these places. This codifies that. It does contain some statutory ability that they need in order to do a couple of things. for instance, one that I know of is in lines 29 to 31, it allows their employees to be commissioned as federal officers. Again, those of you on the Marijuana Committee might remember we did that for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission in 2015. But they have already entered into that contract, and this largely codifies it.
If I could, that would be the feds have standards you have to meet to be commissioned, and so it's the same. It's the federal standards that would apply as far as being commissioned.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, correct. As long as the employees met those standards, they could be commissioned.
Okay.
This just gives them the statutory authority to send their employees to do
the training.
So there are some policy choices in here, but a lot of this is streamlining. I could go through it in more detail if you have other questions. More significant is probably Section 17, which is the piece that handles the local public health authorities or the governing of public health at the county level. So at the county level, there is also basically this directs counties to implement public health programs that at the very minimum replicate state law with respect to tobacco products and electronic cigarette regulation. So at the very minimum, you're going to run a program in the county that does that.
Yes.
Just clarification. You said so a county could go above and beyond what is in state law out there? Because I thought what we were trying to do is get a uniform standard everywhere. But what you're telling me is that is the minimum they have to do, but they could do more than that at their own discretion?
Senator Mona Sanderson, Chair Cruz, correct. In this draft, as it currently is written, they could do additional standards and protocols for governing tobacco products and e-cigarettes.
And Senator Cruz, I think that with Multnomah County, they already have a very robust enforcement or licensure process. They don't want to go backwards. The same with Lane County. And evidently, Clackamas County wants to come up with one also. So they each want to do their own thing. I know this is what we had worked on to get bipartisan last time. We couldn't get there. We couldn't get the votes no matter what. So this is the way we're going to try to see what will happen with this. But we're always open to suggestions.
All right, and just to tie everything together, if you go back to section, I believe it's 12, which is the section about the intergovernment agreement. In order to make these programs work together, the Department of Revenue, the counties, and the Oregon Health Authority are required to share information with one another, and the department and because OHA and the counties have to pay for their own programs, they adopt fees, but then they inform what their fee level is to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue is going to collect that at the time that they require a fee payment for licensure. So retail sellers will have to pay that fee at that point, and then the Department of Revenue is going to distribute it to the other parties.
And we'll have the Department of Revenue here in the next panel.
All right.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to call up the state agencies. Deanna Mack from Department of Revenue, Kristen Gilman, Assistant Attorney General, Cheryl Heemstra, Legislative Director, Oregon Department of Justice, and Karen Gerard, is that net? Karen? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. That's different than I call up the public officials first. Okay, since Department of Revenue isn't here yet,
it won't come up.
Yeah, we will have Dr. Jen Vines, Multnomah County Health Officer, Jay Bosevich, Lane County Commissioner, and Don Emmerich, Clackamas County Public Health Director. Correct. actually a state agency. Okay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Dr. Jennifer Vines. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 235. I'm here as the Deputy Health Officer for Multnomah County. I've been a public health and primary care physician in the Portland metro area for 10 years. You've already heard from a lot of doctors today. I will just briefly add that when I worked in primary care, I saw up close the ravages of tobacco and nicotine on individuals, essentially all of whom began as teenagers. And I really moved into a career in public health exactly for moments like this, when we have a huge opportunity for prevention. So thank you for your time today. I'll just state clearly, tobacco retail licensing is a best practice for cutting down on illegal sales to minors. This bill brings us in line with a majority of other states that require a license to sell what remains a national and global killer. As you know, and as you've heard today, the Multnomah County Commissioners have taken the issue of youth tobacco and nicotine use very seriously. In 2015, we passed a local ordinance requiring tobacco retail licensing, and I can tell you a bit about it. We consider it a success. It went into effect last July 1st, so 2016. We have licensed over 700 retailers. The annual fee is $580. Again, that is what it costs to run the program. We went to great lengths to make sure that we engaged with the business community and that we did it right. So we educated our local business leaders. We provided materials in 7 languages. We notified business owners of the new requirement in many industry publications. And we purposely delayed compliance activities for the first 6 months just to give everybody time to get prepared and make sure they were doing it right. We plan to continue to provide this kind of assistance so that our retailers can lawfully sell these products in our county. But we're also prepared to enforce penalty if needed in the spirit of protecting our young people. The question of enforcement came up earlier. I can tell you that for us, it's an inspections-based approach to enforcement with youth inspectors. Any violation on an inspection results in a remediation plan, usually followed up with a drop-in unannounced visit to make sure that the remediation plan's been effective. Again, always an emphasis on education from our standpoint. I want to just take a moment and highlight our specific support for language in the bill holding the clerk and the owner responsible for sales to minors. We also appreciate that there's no mention of penalizing youth in any way for possession of these products. We know that many young people, in particular those youth of color, may already be addicted to these products, and frankly, they deserve our support to quit rather than any fines or legal action. Again, thank you for your time and attention to this very important matter, and again, this big public health opportunity.
Chair Monez Anderson and Vice Chair Cruz and the members of the Senate Health Committee. For the record, my name is Dawn Emmerich. I'm the new public health director for Clackamas County. I have 25 years of public health and health care experience. Came here from Florida. Nice winters, by the way. I'm also here as a member and as a voice of the Coalition for Local Health Officials. Thank you very much for allowing us and myself to be here in front of you today representing Clackamas County and our support for Senate Bill 235. As we've heard pretty much all morning, we know that tobacco remains the number one most preventable cause of illness and death in America. Because of this, Clackamas County is in full support of Senate Bill 235, along with other partners that we've heard from today. And we want to be very committed to reducing the use of tobacco and other nicotine products as a top priority in our county. It does align with our community health improvement plan as well, that we're working very closely with all of the CCOs in the hospitals as well. So we have a very unified approach to reducing tobacco. The data from the 2015 Oregon Health Healthy Teen Survey indicates that 28% of 11th graders in Clackamas County used some form of tobacco product within the last 30 days. It's also said that 35%, they said it would be very easy to actually get some tobacco if they wanted it. The recently released report of the state's tobacco retail inspection program affirms that 25% of the attempted tobacco purchases of minors in Clackamas County were successful. 25%. In the fall of 2016, Clackamas County Board of County Commissioners evaluated the options of actually doing this in our county. I was the one that presented it to the board. They were very much in favor of this policy, but wanted to see the state and take the lead on this so that we could have a nice partnership between the county and the state. You know, and we do this already. We do regulation. Our environmental health regulatory piece is very successful and one that we take great pride in, knowing that we work with small business and have the trust of small businesses already. We have a platform of good, solid tobacco policy with smoke-free parks. This is work that we do very well and we take very serious with our relationships with small businesses. So State Bill 235 consists of three main components, as we mentioned. Number one, Senate Bill 235 creates a uniform statewide licensing program administered by the Department of Revenue while maintaining the flexibility of local control, which is really what our county commissioners really loved about this bill. The component will allow us to track the tobacco and inhalant delivery product sales and maintain an inventory of the businesses. We heard earlier that there really isn't a whole lot of evidence around the vaping usage. Well, this would provide us that opportunity to start collecting some of the data so that maybe in 5 to 10 years we can come back with some very strong public health data. Number two, Senate Bill 235 sets a state minimum requirement and allows the Board of County Commissioners to implement the stronger time, place, and manner ordinances. We love that flexibility. We certainly want to adhere to the standard of this state, bill and policy, but it also gives us the flexibility to address the needs of our community from a policy perspective. Three, Senate Bill 235 streamlines the licensing process for those who have multiple locations, as we mentioned. This also gives that business the opportunity to file with one agency, and that is the Department of Revenue. Clackamas County sees Senate Bill 235 as a foundational piece of legislation and an effective way to limit the youth access to tobacco. I have a son that is 17, and he tells me of those stories of high school where the seniors are buying the cigarettes. And so this is also very personal to me as well. A uniform statewide retail licensing program will provide us the necessary infrastructure to support the measure and of the effectiveness of the tobacco and nicotine products. Finally, Clackamas County Commissioners strongly support retail licensing and other means to prevent youth access to tobacco and other nicotine products. We urge your support for Senate Bill 235, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be in front of you today.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, again, Jay Bozovich, Lane County Commissioners, and I'm here to urge support for Senate Bill 235 on behalf of our board. I want to first jump back and correct the number I gave you. I said it was $250. It's actually $200 is our retail license fee right now, and it's $125 after the first year if there are no violations, so it drops to $125 annually. We passed our retail licensing back in 2014 at the same time that we adopted no sales of vaping devices to minors prior to the state's adoption of that rule. And at that time, some of the authority of public health boards was somewhat in question of whether or not we could enforce our will on cities and actually extend our licensing inside cities. Most theories said we could, but we chose not to push the limits and cause animosity between municipalities and the county, and only had our ordinance effective in unincorporated areas. Most of our cities have a tobacco retail licensing, but not all. So there are actually holes in Lane County where there is no licensing of tobacco retailers. This bill would close that gap, and with the establishment of the public health modernization, it's clarified the role of counties as the Board of Public Health and having jurisdiction over the entire county. And I think this supports that in Section 17. Allowing the counties, and particularly 17.3, allowing the counties to charge a fee, which prevents it from being an unfunded mandate, which is very important to the counties. It's a well-written bill. I think it's important to kind of get this to be more statewide. One of the things we struggle with the most, because we're going to only act in our unincorporated areas, was causing boundary issues where there was a retailer that was within 200 feet of another retailer, but there was a city limit between the two of them, where we were going to make it unfair to one or the other by what we were going to require as part of that retail licensing. So this kind of at least establishes a minimum set of standards for the entire state and eliminates a lot of boundary issues. So I just again wanted to say my support and the board's support for Senate Bill 235.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Once again, I'd like to know more about your enforcement. How does that work? Is it just the you had mentioned that licensure is the most effective way, but it strikes me that just licensure alone isn't going to do much other than tell you who's selling it. So how are you in planning, or how do you enforce it?
Experience as well.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I'd be happy to get more details for you. What I can tell you is, again, it is a combination of complaint-based. A parent says, my kid was able to buy this at such and such a store. Public health sends someone to respond. And also youth inspectors, so people who are actually under the legal age limit going in, having a look around, and potentially trying to purchase the products.
Doing a sting.
Again, we call them youth inspectors. That's the preferred term.
I think it's twofold. One, it is complaint-driven. Mostly is what we're doing now is complaint-driven. Our program had kind of a soft rollout, so it's really just starting to generate some revenue. So it hasn't generated enough to run youth inspections yet. But we are doing on-site inspections for things like signage, et cetera. And generally, a retailer that is willing to get licensed and be licensed will obey the law. Talking with the small retail association in our county, they all want to obey the law and adhere with the law. So that's really part of the program, and just having the licensing program makes them understand all their requirements under the law as part of that license. And that license fee helps us get that educational material to them, and then at least do one on-site inspection for things like product placement away, where it can't just be picked up and shoplifted, signage, etc. So, we haven't started yet doing minor decoy enforcement, but that may come with time.
So if we have a statewide license, and that's the effect of having a license, why do we also need local licenses?
Each county wants to have their own enforcement. Multnomah County has a much more intense program. Clackamas County may not want to have that.
Yeah.
And we have about 25 minutes to go before we need to be out of here.
We get two licenses.
And it may be that we're going to need to carry this over if we can't get everyone to testify. Any other questions? There have been issues regarding grandfathering in existing retailers. Because right now the bill is written so that when they renew the second time around, they can't sell anymore. Other changing premises to changing individual to premise, and the civil penalty up to $5,000. So those are things that we may need to get information back from you on how you view those concerns. Okay. All right. Let us call up Deanna Mack, Kristen Gilman, Cheryl Hemstra, and Karen Gerard.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can we make sure that we have people that have come from over 50 miles away testify today if they've come?
Yes, Suzanne Kelso.
Maybe she can be up next.
Yeah, we'll go through this panel and then we'll call her up. Yeah, there is one. Deanna, do you want to start?
Certainly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and thank you for your grace in allowing me to finish testifying next door before coming here. I understand that Mark Mayer already gave an overview of the bill itself, so I won't go over that. But I did want to let you know that for the department, a statewide retail license actually helps us with our tax enforcement as well as the public health benefits that these folks, I'm sure, have already testified about. It gives us a more accurate list of retailers for our ability to... when a floor tax is imposed, when you guys raise the rates, we know exactly who it is that is out there. We also, currently we're relying on our list of, kind of an old, outdated list, you could say, and of people who have previously filed tax returns, floor tax returns. I think the most recent change was when we raised it from 13 cents, but prior to that it was 2002, and so we had a very outdated list between the times you guys raised the rates. It does assist us in our tax compliance. We do inspections now, and the revocation procedures allow us a bigger teeth for non-compliance of our tax provisions. Right now we are allowed to impose up to $1,000 civil penalty, but this revocation or suspension process also assists with the enforcement of the tobacco tax laws of the state. I thought I heard that there was a comment about the license being a premises license. I don't know if that is, I think it can be issued to a person, but we are envisioning that it would be a per premises license. It would be posted at each premises for going forward. The revocation provisions, too, if we find out that a person doesn't have a license, it allows that upon inspection, it allows us to treat the product that's in the store as contraband, which they would then have 30 days to appeal that. We would be able to immediately seize it, and it would be subject to forfeiture. They would then have 30 days to appeal that to show that they had a license or other type of thing, and then it would go to the incinerator in Brooks, where the other contraband goes. So with that, that's all I have about for the Department of Revenue. If you have any questions.
Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned inspections. What does the inspection consist of?
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Beyer, an inspection that the Department of Revenue does, we currently have indicia on our cigarette packages. It's called a stamp that represents.
You're just looking to see if they have
stamps?
We're
looking to make sure they have a stamp on our cigarette products, and then we are looking to make sure that they have invoices that show that they are not selling untaxed tobacco products for the other products in the store. So they have to match, and they're, it's an inspection. They just have to have the information available when we show up. It's not like an audit where we say, compile your records. We'll be there in a couple of weeks. We do go out there and kind of surprise inspect in that program.
And just real quick, the way it's written, different counties will have different fees to pay.
Correct.
Is that going to be an issue for the Department of Revenue?
Senator Monis Anderson, we are able to collect the fees depending on whatever they are for the state. It'll be some sort of table driven based on the county location and the amount of fee that agency charges. We pass the fee for OHA to OHA. We pass the fee that is to the local governments, to the local public health authorities, I believe is how the arrangement is in there. And that is not a problem for our agency. We're very good at distributing funds for you good folks to spend in different areas.
Any other questions? All right. Before you go on, we really do need, thank you, Senator Knope. I really feel it's important for Suzanne Kelso from Deschutes to testify. So I'd like her to give her testimony since she drove. The others can stay there, but.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for giving me this opportunity to speak.
My name is Suzanne Kelso. I represent the Oregon Premium Retail Tobacconist Associations. We're the brick and mortar cigar shops on the corner. And we're here in response to this bill for licensing as in, not in favor as it's structured. We are in favor in licensing in general, that the Department of Revenue having a list makes sense to us. I was told last fall that that request was a $25 fee associated with creating that list. We want people selling tobacco appropriately, and licensing gives an opportunity to make sure people are playing in the right, from the right standpoint. I think the biggest issue that we have with the way this is drafted, beyond the fact that it would go to beyond just a Department of Department of Revenue licensing, is the fee structures that are being requested. They're undefined. I know that Legislative Council mentioned that the state of Oregon is contracted with the FDA for inspection. I've included the list of all state agencies that are contracted with the FDA that I've for you to reference. As of December 22nd, on their website, it said OHA's contract expired on 10-12, or 10-16, sorry. They had that contract for 1 year. Since 2010, $221 million have been released to states for inspections of retailers for tobacco sales. Oregon has received $495,000 of that. I don't know why. I do know it feels unfair as a business operator in Oregon that I would be asked to pay for that when there are federal resources that are not being taken advantage of. Washington has received $7 million, Idaho $4.5 million. I'm not sure why Oregon isn't playing in that game, but it's $580 at a county level, whatever the OHA, I know they wanted $300 last year for this licensing. The numbers grow, and for us as small operators, it's a big number. We also have customers in our, we're a wholesale distributor as well, golf courses, convention center, gift shops, not places youth are buying, but it would put them out of business for a marginal opportunity for sales in a very difficult, still in a very difficult economic environment in a lot of those environments. So we would, you're essentially taking their opportunity to make those profits away from them, and they're not going to be your suspect places of sales since minors are rarely in their environments alone. It would be our request. There's already inspections for the FDA, for SINAR, the OHA, the Department of Revenue, that there be coordination of those, funding of those off of the list that the Department of Revenue could generate from this bill, with resources from the federal government that are readily available and not being accessed adequately. If you can imagine, we have Department of Revenue inspectors come, we have Department of Health inspectors come, and we are consistently above what is necessary for education and sales practices. And I know with the latest SINAR report, as a state, we were over 94% in compliance as tobacco retailers for not selling to minors. So we are doing the best that we can do as an industry, and we, in particular, as premium retailers, are, take it to heart every day. We pay attention to this and train our employees to make sure we're doing the right things. I have provided information related to the FDA and all of the FDA's encouragement of all of their resources being used for state and local enforcement. We need to be doing a better job of accessing resources from the federal government and not putting the burden on Oregon taxpayers when we have enough burden as it is. So I request that that be considered as you consider this bill.
Thank you. And some of these questions, we will need to get feedback from the agency, from OHA, regarding that. And yes, we did meet, and when the bill was drafted, we still have the information that you sent us, but the way it was crafted was amongst Multnomah County, the Oregon Health Division, and then now we want your testimony to see if what you would like could be incorporated into it. So Thank you. And also, Department of Revenue, it costs them $25. So whatever the county charges, there will be a fee, and then it would be $25. So say you're Deschutes County, and we just and your commissioners do not want to have an intensive program, your fee would be $25 a year, unless the public health authority decides to have a more robust program like Multnomah County does, and even Lane County doesn't have a robust program. Does that make sense?
I understand the premise. I don't believe it's fair to us as retailers to have to deal with multiple layers of regulation and enforcement. I think the state does have a role to play here. There are many statutes in place associated with tobacco, and we are required federally to be inspected for youth enforcement. All of those things are already in place. So having a more robust program associated with making sure we're not selling to anyone under the legal age does not add up for me in terms of, I'm not in Multnomah County, but $580 to be told I'm not selling to minors is not exactly a great return of my investment as a business operator.
Question.
Just a clarification on what you said, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I believe the Oregon Health Authority has the ability to assess a fee in this as well, so it's not just the $25. It could be much more than that, depending upon what OHA thinks they need.
We'll get into that a little later, but you're right. Okay, I am concerned. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. I am concerned that there are people out there that will not be able to come back to our next public hearing on this bill. So I would like to know if there are any people that could not come back and you would like to give your testimony today. Okay. So let, yeah.
Thank you.
Have you signed up? Yeah.
I gave it back.
Please proceed. Introduce yourself.
My name is Britton Snook, Chair Senator Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Senator Cruz. Now, both this involves an enforcement on the business itself, and I am not a business owner nor am I an employee of these businesses included in nicotine delivery systems or tobacco products. But I am a consumer, and these directly affect me, for when they affect the business itself or the age of the consumer, I happen to be in between the ages of 18 and 21. So what would happen if these were to be enforced on the business and myself? Would I be struck with MIPs, or would I be getting my own property that I have paid for while it was legal in the past? Would I be getting these confiscated from me and then therefore charged even more on top of it with fees or tickets or even criminal records for having it?
The consumer will not be affected. It is the premise that sells it that would be affected if it's complaint driven.
Along with the enforcement of the age restrictions as well.
Yeah, if that bill.
Madam Chair.
And on top of that, if they're getting charged more fees, wouldn't this encourage a price increase to our to the consumers themselves?
That would be up to the retailer.
It would be up to the Department of Revenue and the OHAA, depending on how much they charge these businesses, because you can only make up for so much on what you're getting charged for what you don't anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
It would be
be up to the retailer to determine.
Madam Chair, if I may, I mean, I appreciate the concerns that you're raising. I would say that, I mean, if you think about even Multnomah County's fee, which is pretty high, if you divide it by the total amount of product that any retailer sells, I think it's a pretty minimal increase. I can pretty well guarantee you they do more than 5,800 transactions, 58,000 transactions of these products a year, which amounts to a penny per transaction, even if they did it past the price along to consumers. So I appreciate your concern in that regard, but I don't think if you do the arithmetic, it turns out to be a really significant price increase. And as to your concern about having products confiscated, I mean, the reality is law enforcement generally has better things to do. We're only just giving them the opportunity that if they happen to be encountering somebody, if you're using product in the privacy of your own home, nobody's going to come storming in there and confiscate them from you. In the long term, hopefully, we won't have people under 21 using product. I'm sorry that you're using them now because I don't want that detriment to your health.
If I may respond, no offense, miss, but nicotine delivery systems are proven to be at their worst 95% safer than all tobacco products, and therefore I'm 95% safer than what you're sorry for.
That's great.
Thank you, Chair Senator Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Senator Cruz. I actually originally signed up to speak for the prior bill, but it all kind of ties into both of them. I just wanted to say that I've listened to everything that everyone has said, and if we are truly talking about hair health...
Oh, you need to say your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jason Weber. I'm on the board of the Northwest Vapers Association, and I also own Vape Crusaders in Roseburg, Oregon. So.
Thank you.
I just want to say if this is all truly everything everyone has said about health care, then if, you know, I want to obey the laws too. And if we could find a way to separate vaping from smoking, because I've just heard a lot about how smoking kills, and I completely agree, you know, 4,000 chemicals, 50 carcinogenics, you know, one of the biggest things that's killing everyone each year. Also, one of the biggest reasons I do what I do and why I'm in business. I've heard things like nicotine causes cancer, which I'd like to see where that research came from. Also, you know, nicotine is addictive. Well, yes, in a cigarette, it's wrapped in ammonia and 4,000 other chemicals, so cigarettes are addictive. But when you take that substance out, we're looking at something like caffeine. So when it's in a vaporizer with a couple other ingredients, and as my customer and friend actually just said, it's been proven by the Royal College physicians and New England Health that it is at least 95% safer than tobacco products. So I just keep hearing the same thing, and it's really hammering tobacco. However, our vaping industry is kind of being clued in with that, and it hurts really bad because what we're doing is trying to do the same things everyone else is saying they're trying to do, which is help people's health. So that was basically it. I just wanted to point that there are differences, and if we could break those apart, that would be much appreciated, and I'd be more on board with what everybody is saying. Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate you for coming. All right, everyone. We are going to have to carry this bill over to Thursday, December 9th, and we will continue the public hearing on December 9th. Any other questions?
Okay. Did you say December, Madam Chair?
Pardon?
You said December. You meant
February.
I say December?
No, December 9th is fine.
February 9th will be the next public hearing on Senate Bill 235.
Dang.
Any other corrections for the good of the order? All right, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235, and we're adjourned.
It's been a really great day for me.